This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
The most exciting part of a vacation stay at a home rental? Easy. It's being greeted upon arrival with a rusted lockbox affixed to the underside of a stranger's condo. Yeah, you simply twist knobs, click gears, jiggle it, and then rip it off its moorings, and voila! Your prize is a key to a questionable home rental and maybe tetanus. When you just want to get your vacation started by actually getting into your room, it matters where you stay. At Hilton, we deliver your key right to your phone on the Hilton Honors app. Hilton, for the stay.
Hi, I'm your inner dream monologue, and you're fast asleep, so I'll be quick. Great job using the Colgate Optic White Overnight Teeth Whitening Pen before bed. When used as directed, it gives you a visibly whiter smile in just 7 days. So while I fly and talk to animals, you're removing teeth stains with ease. Sweet dreams. And when you wake up, keep on living life to the brightest. Colgate Optic White. Find it at all major retailers.
Hi, I'm Allie Gertz.
And I'm Julia Prescott. And this podcast is brought to you by
Everything's Coming Up Simpsons. Make sure to tune in on September 11th.
We are talking about the episode Radio Bart with a special guest you may recognize.
Hi, I'm Nancy Cartwright.
And actually, I'm Bart Simpson. Who the hell are you?
We're so excited.
Oh, this is so good.
This was one of our favorite episodes we've ever done.
Mark your calendars. I don't know. You're probably already downloading it. What is this life?
September 11th, we are joined by, you already heard her, Nancy Cartwright. We're so excited. Please tune in.
All right. Bye.
Today's episode is brought to you by Last Rampage, the new true crime film starring Robert Patrick, Heather Graham, and Bruce Davison. And we had the pleasure of speaking to someone involved with the movie.
My name is Robert Patrick. I play Gary Tyson. That's Gary Tyson with an I in the film Last Rampage. Evil broke loose in 1978, Arizona State Penitentiary. You know, that was interesting. What it was like playing a real person as opposed to a fictional character. It was really trying to wrap your head around how this guy could do some of the things that he could do. That was the things that you were drawn on. Of course, there was no way you're going to try to do an impersonation of a guy, nor was I going to try to, you know, get as heavy as the guy. I didn't have enough time to really go that route. But I found him really, really interested in trying to live up to the charisma that he had. I fell in love with the folklore of the story, like the whole idea that he was a guy that was raised during the Great Depression. See, that from a historical point of view, those kind of stories resonate with me. That yearning for something better, trying to find it, have to steal to get it. How do you deal with that if you're a religious person? You know, how do you run underneath that? How do you justify it? He had a double life sentence that he began to push his wife and his kids to say, God, you know, I'm going to serve one term, and when I die, I'm going to serve another term in hell. I got to get out of this. And the length that he was willing to go to get his kids to help him get through this and get him out of prison, it was fascinating to me.
Don't miss Last Rampage, the true story of the prison break of Gary Tyson. In theaters September 22nd and available for on-demand pre-order August 22nd. Find out more on Twitter by following @LastRampageFilm or on Facebook.com/LastRampageFilm.
Hey guys, this is Kumail. Welcome to the X-Files. So here's the issue I just found out is that the episode I recorded with Matt Myra, where we talked about Firewalker and Red Museum, turns out the file is corrupt and it is unreleasable and there is really no way to get it back. So we're trying to figure out how to fix that. Obviously, both of those episodes, you know, I said I would cover them. Honestly, I just found out 2 minutes ago, so I really have no idea what we're going to do. But what I am doing right now is we're going to release the Glenn Morgan episode. So what you're going to listen to is the Glenn Morgan episode. Glenn Morgan, of course, is the writer from the first couple seasons of The X-Files, who, I can't even say The X-Files. First couple seasons, him and James Wong wrote a bunch of the great episodes, and these guys really had a hand and shaping the X-Files and making the X-Files what it is. He left for season three. He leaves halfway through season two, in fact. And then he came back season four and they wrote some fantastic episodes. So this is a really, really great episode. I really like talking to Glenn. I was really nervous to meet him, obviously. I'm such a fan of his. And, you know, I love the Final Destination movies. And he's done a lot of awesome stuff. His show, in fact, called Intruders, is on BBC America right now. It airs after Doctor Who on Saturdays. And I really like that show, too. It's Darren Morgan is also involved on that show. And it's just got some really, like, creepy atmosphere to it. It's very spooky. I've seen the first two episodes. I've been traveling, so I haven't seen the third one yet, but it's a really, really great show, and I highly recommend you get into it. So I was really sort of curious as to, you know, how these guys wrote these episodes, how they got the ideas and stuff. And again, I will sort of break down the interview a little bit afterwards, so stay for that. And again, I just found out those files are gone, the Red Museum and Firewalker one. Now, Firewalker, I'm sort of okay skipping, even though it was such a great episode. It's such a bummer that this happened. But, you know, this kind of stuff happens. The Red Museum one, obviously, that episode ties into the main arc in sort of an interesting way. It's an episode that really... you know, it's a little bit all over the place, but at the end it ties into mythology in an interesting way. So what I think I'm going to do actually is, the Kevin Smith episode is next week. So I'm going to attach, maybe just talk about the two episodes on my own in depth, attach that as the intro to the Kevin Smith episode. And then at the end of that episode, Emily and I did a mini episode where we talked about Excelsior's Day. That's the one about ghost rape in the old folks home. So then the next episode was going to be Kevin Smith, and that's going to have a discussion of three episodes, two with just me sort of going over stuff I thought was interesting. One with Emily, where we really sort of get into the issue of ghost rape. And then a really great conversation with Kevin Smith, who was a great guy. So really, really sorry about those guys. Obviously, it's nobody's fault. This kind of stuff happens. It could have been worse. It could have happened to two really, really classic, fantastic episodes. If this had happened to One Breath or to Dwayne Barry or Ascension, I would be completely devastated. And obviously, this really, really, really sucks. But, you know, could always be worse. So it's nobody's fault, really. Anyway, so this is my interview with Glenn Morgan, who was really fantastic. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about the interview afterwards.
Yeah, and you just, because I, you know, the friend of mine who pointed this out to me.
Yeah.
She does behind the scenes stuff. I actually met her on those alt X-Files.
Alt.tv.xfiles?
Yeah, back then. She was like a kid graduating or starting film school back in Toronto. And so then I became friends with her on that because I could tell like she could write and she was like a good kid.
Yeah.
And so when we did Final Destination, I said, if you can find a place to stay in Vancouver, you can be my assistant. And from there, then she did the behind the scenes on Willard, and now she does all the stuff. She works with Cronenberg, all the making of stuff.
Oh, wow.
Fincher and all the Fargo. series.
Oh, is she working in Fargo?
Yeah, but when she subtitles me because I don't finish my sentence or something. I'm like, what are you doing? I'm fucking speaking English.
No, you sound great. Yeah.
Okay, well, all right.
And the Final Destination, that was an X-Files pitch, right? That then got turned into...
Not that I know of. It might have been because there was the other guy.
It was
Jeff.
How did you get involved with that?
New Line was going after all the X-Files writers, and they brought us in and said, "Here's this idea." And then Jim and I go, "No, only do it if you can't see death," because they would never go for that. And then they did.
Yeah, I mean, what's death gonna look like?
I know, but every Halloween, I'm like, oh, damn, there's no merchandising.
You know, I really like those Final Destination movies. Out of all the new, like, horror franchises, like Saw, Paranormal Activity, whatever,
right.
I think those embrace, like, the fun of their premise the most.
I hope, yeah, you know, I hope they should be seen as comedies because they're so crazy. Well, that's, I know Amanda from the third one.
Oh.
She plays Monica.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I own the newest one because I stupidly got a 3D TV and they don't have many like 3D movies, but I've seen that one a bunch of times.
The one with the bridge?
Yes. Oh no, it's the car. It's the car race. It's the
that's the fourth one, I think.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, Kristen was in the first one. She got killed. She was the teacher.
Oh,
got
wow.
Off the plane, and then all the knives stabbed her.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
One of my favorite ones is the one where the guy's working out, and, like, you see the cable snap, and it, like, smashes his head.
Yeah.
I really like that. Yeah. That's the fun of it. It's, like, there's a room, and then you see, like, one thing, then you see another thing. You know, like, they all, like, sort of line up slowly. Right. Yeah, I think it's awesome.
I spent, like, 3 days at the Home Depot on Sunset and Van Ness or whatever.
Yeah.
Just going from aisle to aisle. Okay. Nothing to do that. I was like so paranoid. And then no one ever said, "What are you doing in here, mister?"
Yeah.
I was just like touching pointed things. And, you know, I didn't know that they keep certain chemicals over there away from these chemicals over there because if they were to spill and, you know, people would be gassed.
Oh, wow. Like that. Yeah. That's awesome. So I'm talking to Glenn Morgan, one of the, you know, you wrote like from the first two seasons, like some of the best episodes, some of the ones that really established what the X-Files was going forward. And the way we met was interesting. So you had been, from my perspective, you know, there was a guy who was tweeting at me about X-Files every now and then. And then at one point you said the word "we," and then I looked at your name and I was like, wait, is this the Glenn Morgan who wrote like the best episodes? And you were like, well, I didn't write the best ones. I was like, holy shit, this is so exciting. Yeah.
Yeah. No, my I have a friend in Toronto. She's like a adopted sister. She says, "Oh, you got to listen to this podcast." She always tells me, "Oh, you got to look up. You got to read this.
Yeah.
Oh, you got to have this thing. These guys said this." I'm like, you know, it's any of us have that thing in their lives from 20 years ago, and if you're still daily doing that, it's
of
like
course.
You got to move on.
Right.
But she said, "No, you got to listen. Very insightful and funny."
Oh,
and then
thank
my
you.
Brother Darren.
Yeah.
He's like, "Oh, you got to hear this guy." Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so I'm working in Vancouver, and I was on my way to the airport, and I was like, I was just laughing my head off.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, and I've been emailing you with your brother Darren. I'm going to have him on.
Oh, good.
Towards
and
the
I
end.
Talked to Jim Wong last night, who'd be more than happy to come here.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, awesome. Great. Yeah, Darren's going to come on at the end of season three because that's sort of the bulk of his work.
Right.
He does Humbug in this season, but then Clyde Bruckman and all of those are next season. Mm-hmm. So I've been emailing with you a little bit, trying to figure out what we're going to talk about, sort of focus it a little bit because I have so many questions. And you basically said that you guys, you and James Wong, your job was sort of the characters. Like that was sort of like developing Mulder and Scully's characters was sort of your specialty, right?
Well, yeah, look, everybody, it's hard to talk about because everybody, I mean, it sounds like, you know, you're just trying to be nice guy, but really, truly, that show is a team effort. Chris led the way and everybody joined in. And I think a show becomes successful for a long time because, you know, like in sports, you get a free agent comes in. So when Darren comes in or when Vince Gilligan comes in, you know, it's like, you're like, you can go on forever. But that first year was like Chris, Howard and Alex, Jim and I. Marilyn Osborne was there. But out of the producers, it just fell into Chris did some mythology. Jim and I did monsters and character stuff, and Howard and Alex did weird science. That's generally, but not intentionally, but that's just how it fell out.
And how did you get involved with the show? Did you know Chris Carter from before?
No, Jim and I got kind of started at Stephen J. Cannell.
Uh-huh.
We're working on 21 Jump Street.
Uh-huh.
And Peter Roth ran Cannell's company then, with his executive working with him as Marilyn Osborne. Peter went to Fox. Jim and I, we worked on a commish with Michael Chiklis.
Uh-huh.
And then we were going to go work on the show that year. The big pilot was a show called Moon Over Miami that Harvey Payton, it was a comedy, romantic comedy in Miami. Yeah. And he had been involved in Twin Peaks, which is like one of the greatest things ever made.
Right.
So I met with him. He's a good guy. And we're going, hey, we're going to go do this. And then our agent said, Peter Roth is demanding that you watch this pilot. He's begging you. And Peter's that kind of guy. Oh, please. And so we went to our agent's office and we watched the pilot. And we're like, oh.
It's pretty good.
Wow, that's really good. Oh, we got a problem. They go, no, we'll go. And we hadn't seen the other show's pilot.
Moon Over Miami.
Moon Over Miami. And so we went and watched it that day. And we're like, oh. we got a problem. And so we backed out of that. And I was chewed out.
Were you? But yeah. It was the right decision, obviously.
No, and that guy is like a good guy. We're friends with him, the head of Columbia at the time.
Yeah.
And later he's like, you made the right decision.
Yeah. X-Files is X-Files.
Yeah, so we didn't know Chris, and we went and we met him. And
yeah.
And
there are no podcasts about Moon Over Miami, you know? They're not going to have many episodes. This is the closest, this is the most Moon Over Miami has been talked about on a podcast.
In 20 years.
Yeah. So what's interesting is the way that the show is set up, you have, you know, Mulder and because Scully's brought in to sort of debunk Mulder. And in a way, these two characters are set up as opposing viewpoints. But then when you do that, the challenge is to also make them feel like real people, you know, so that they're not just like avatars for these different points of view.
Mm-hmm.
And as the season goes, actually, right from the beginning, their chemistry is so good that, you know, you never really feel like they're just like a collection of ideas. They always feel like real people. But what were the sort of conversations you guys had to make sure that it wasn't just them sort of, you know, representing viewpoints rather than being people?
Well, I remember we said if they ever, you know, I don't like it rules, you know. I think, from what I'm told, I never did it. Or, you know, and I'm saying I back, this is like Jim and I.
Yeah.
Never went to Star Trek. And I was told they had a Bible that was like 40 pounds or something. And it had a lot of like, can't do this, can't do that. I hate that.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I get it.
Yeah.
But it's just like you're putting limits on yourself. But we did say if she ever sees an alien or they ever kiss, the show's over. So that was like kind of the only kind of rules in my memory that we went after. And, you know, it's like any show that you get to know the actors. And, you know, Duchovny is very charismatic and funny and very smart and will go, he should do this, I should do that. And so they really, and you just watch dailies. And so the characters really start to grow, not necessarily out of our small brains, but watching David and Jillian interact and go, they would do this good, or they do that good, or we should bring this, we need someone else to do this for them. And, you know, that's how that develops. Did that make any sense?
Yes. No, you did. But I mean, for me, it's sort of tricky because, you know, she's her character in a way. And I sort of got the sense right in the beginning when I'm reading those message boards, because Mulder is more oftentimes right, even though she's more reasonable and is using a scientific method, she's sort of like an emissary from our normal world into this other crazy world.
Yeah,
so the odds are kind of stacked against her.
Executives call that our window. What's
right.
Our point of entry.
Right. She's the point of view person.
Yeah.
Right. She's right. Watson.
Right.
But then,
exactly.
But then, it seems like it must have been hard then to, you know, I watched the show, and one of the things that, you know, I haven't watched the show in a while, and one of the jokes that people always make about the X-Files is like, how long is she gonna not fucking believe this stuff, you know? It's stretching believability that she's like not buying in. But watching the show, that's something I think that you put onto it later if you haven't watched the show in a while. Mm-hmm. Watching the show, she's very reasonable, and she does a really good job of sort of, you know, buying into what she needs to buy into. She's just not jumping to the craziest conclusion. She's using, like, the scientific method.
Mm-hmm.
So what was the challenge there, like, making sure, like, you know, like you said, like, make sure she never sees an alien. But then there are times when she does buy into it. Like, what was that balance for you guys of figuring out when she is going to be, you know, sort of really trying hard to not believe versus, you know, sort of buying into Mulder?
Well, it's really tough. Mulder's the fun one.
Right.
He, you know, he had a lot of the jokes. He's believing in all this weird stuff that, that's a brilliant thing. That's a brilliant thing that Chris, I want to believe.
Right.
I mean, even like the most, Richard Dawkins is like, I want to believe you, or whatever, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, people want to believe it. And so he's just more fun. And Scully's like, no one likes that friend that's going, nah.
Yeah.
Nah. And so much earlier than we anticipated, we needed something that she could have an experience in that realm that would be believable for her to believe in. And we always thought, that, you know, most people will, in that realm, they'll go to ghosts or wanting to be in touch with a loved one that's passed away. Everyone wants that. And so that's, I don't remember what number it was. Beyond the Sea
Beyond
came
the
up
sea.
Much sooner. I would have thought of Beyond the Sea, like when we first started, something like that in year three.
Yeah.
But it just needed it right away. And, you know, she wasn't going to get on a spaceship or whatever. So we tried to design that episode because Jillian's a great actress and all she was doing was going, no, and disproving. You know, the other thing, we talk about Peter Roth. I'm pretty sure his father published the Hardy Boy Nancy Drew mysteries.
Uh-huh.
And Peter, when he began in animation at ABC, so Peter had been very instrumental in developing Scooby-Doo.
Uh-huh.
So there was that model where you look at it is that, you know, Mulder has all the fun, and then at the very end,
yeah,
Scully comes in to go, oh, no, it was probably that. And you go, yeah, oh, you're really bumming us out.
You exactly. You're sticking the mud. You're right.
Yeah, that's right. So that.
Well, but what was interesting was, for instance, I noticed that your guys' episodes did a better job of at Scully, I thought, because there's a in Squeeze, or Tombs, actually, she and Mulder sort of catch the bad guy together. So, you know, Mulder has the crazy theory about a stretchy liver mutant. Mm-hmm. But she's the one who does the profile that's like, hey, he's going to return to the scene of the crime. So you guys, like, give her good stuff to do. So you guys did a really good job of establishing that they make a good team. In Ice, for instance, you know, Mulder's the one who's sort of gone off the deep end. You see mm-hmm. the dark side of his belief, the dark side of his paranoia. And you sort of, Scully's the one who's there sort of calming him down, making sure everyone gets along. So I think you guys did a really good job of, like, you know, making them seem like a good team rather than sort of being in opposition to each other.
Thanks. I mean, you know, again, that was just like watching Jillian. You know, it wasn't like trying to make Jillian do our idea of Scully.
Right.
It was like, this is, Jillian is telling us what Scully should be, and then we would take it and try to challenge her, you know.
And Beyond the Sea, which is one of my favorite episodes, you know, there's a lot of great performances in it. Luther Lee Boggs is amazing. A couple of the things I really love, that first image of the dad talking, his mouth's moving, but nothing's coming out. To me, that is such a great intersection of, like, creepy, but also kind of believable, and also emotionally moving because the dad just died.
Mm-hmm.
How did you come up with that image? It's so creepy, that actor just sitting there just, like, talking, and nothing's coming out.
You know, in research and stuff, it was common phenomenon.
Oh, when people, like, see...
Yeah, Nutter had him, Don Davis is the actor, Nutter has him saying the Lord's Prayer.
Like, right.
Oh, right.
But, whatever.
Yeah, and,
he'd just be saying watermelon over and over.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And never had it in my family or whatever, but that, you know, that's a common thing where people said, oh, I had a dream about this guy or what relative and they died. So it's just in the research.
And for that one, there was one towards the end of the episode. There's a I think Luther Lee Boggs is such a great character too, by the way, because he actor is amazing.
Brad Dourif is you know, you have this series and it wasn't anything like it. We're on Friday and like, you know, and we had that episode. Rick Milligan was casting director, and you know, Rick at first would bring people in and he'd go, no, they were like really network.
Yeah.
No, we want the weirdos.
Yeah.
And then once he've got that, he could really, Rick was great at finding us like, this guy will do it. And you know, Brad Dourif, I mean, Darren and I can't tell you how many times I've seen One Full of Cuckoo's Nest. It's one of my, he's incredible. And, yeah, he's in Blue Velvet, and you know,
and he's not. And then after that, he was in Lord of the Rings,
right? A Ragtime. You know, I mean, I just thought he was great, and but his fee was high for that show. I was like, no, and he had these other names, the other people. I'm like, no, no, it's got to be him. So I'm like, I went to put it out there that I would give up my script fee. And give it there. But, you know, they don't want to, business affairs at a studio doesn't want to set a precedent of like, he got X amount of dollars on this show, then that other show they've got, they got to pay that guy.
Yeah.
So, but I'm like begging. And Chris.
Also, the idea that writers giving up money for actors, that's not good. It should be going the other way.
Well, they want to institutionalize you. It's kind of, I don't want to be giving away my tricks. But when you say, I'll give up this.
Yeah.
They know you mean it, because and before then, they'll just click you off. They're not listening to you, but you go, I mean it.
Yeah.
And Chris heard that, and Chris called Peter Roth on, like, Thanksgiving. So we got to have Brad Dourif, and he just, like, wouldn't let go. And Peter's like, I hate all of you, okay. And to watch those dailies, it's like, it's not even like you wrote it, like somebody way better wrote it. I mean, he's just phenomenal.
I mean, it's such a tough part, because he's essentially, in the beginning, he's an evil guy who's sort of had a little bit of an awakening. Mm-hmm. So he's going to play a guy who, you know, is basically like a serial killer or whatever he is. He's killed his family and all this stuff. But then you also have to buy that he had this transformative experience and he's really, really hurting. And in a way, he's not likable, but he's like sort of a redeemed character. A little bit.
No, I had heard your podcasts about it, and like that was kind of like, you feel, hopefully, it's weird that you feel
bad for him.
That like he is truly going to get the worst possible punishment for what he did.
Right.
You know.
Well, okay, so here's the thing that I said on the podcast, the way I interpreted it, and then I got a lot of emails and a lot of...
Just ignore them.
On Reddit.
Just delete them.
Well, this one is interesting because I hadn't considered this. So at the end, Scully decides to not go and hear the message from her dad. And to me, and the way I talked about it in the podcast, it was really heartbreaking. To me, the idea that she wouldn't give this guy who really just wanted someone to be there when he was dying, she wouldn't give him that. And also her wanting to not believe, that instinct was so strong in her that she would rather give that up than hear a final message from her dad. Then a lot of people online said that I read that wrong, that really it was, you know, her coming to terms with the fact, she's like, I don't need a last message from my dad. I'm comfortable with him. So, and maybe it's some sort of in-between kind of thing there. But to me, it was really like kind of devastating that she didn't go. But how did you guys mean that to happen?
I think kind of all of that.
Yeah.
Hopefully if a thing works, there's a lot of things going in there. But for me, this was years later. I was working on a show called The Others, and which is a
ghost
paranormal thing as well. And my grandfather in New York, in Syracuse, had passed away, and I went back there, and he had a tool, you know, like grandpas do, and I took a Swiss Army knife rusted thing from there. And I work out in my garage, like, it's just, there's really rats up there and stuff. Just like, hell, it's really just not so great. But Kristen keeps trying to fix it. I'm like, don't touch it. So I was up there, it was like 2 a.m, and I had the Mills Brothers, one of my grandfather's favorite bands or musicians from them. And then his knife was there, and I'm writing this scene about all that. And I was like, it was like 2 a.m, and in my imagination, whatever, and I'm like, he's over there.
Yeah.
He's behind me. And I'm like, and I don't believe in it. I'm Scully.
Right.
And all that stuff, but I was like, I can't turn around. And because if he was there,
yeah,
just the world is a whole different
Your whole
setup.
World is fucked.
And so for Scully, I think she was at that point, and maybe at the year nine, she would, you know, she would have a different development.
Right.
But do I sound high?
No, you don't, but that's actually really interesting because one of the things that really works about the episode is the song, the Beyond the Sea, right. And it seems to me it came from you having a connection to the music that your grandfather...
Well, that was my dad's. My Darren is named after Bobby Darin, who sang the American version of Beyond the Sea. It was originally a French song.
Oh, wow. Yeah. But that sort of thing where, you know, music connects you to a person and then how that sort of connect,
right.
I think that's what makes the episode really work, I think, is that it seems to come from a really personal place, even though you don't believe in ghosts and Scully doesn't believe in ghosts, but the parallels between you not wanting to turn back and then Scully seeing something that's undeniably crazy, I think that's what makes that episode really work.
Thanks. It's, you gotta, in anything, you gotta put yourself out there.
And so how much of this, like, so you guys started, I assume, you know, you guys came and met with Chris Carter, and he was like, all right, Mulder's the believer, Scully is the skeptic. That's sort of the most basic dynamic. How many conversations did you guys have? Like, then the hard thing becomes, Mulder's the one driving the episode, right? Like, something crazy happens, Mulder's the one who's like, we got to go figure this out. And Scully's like, we don't have to. And at some point, she sort of buys into the quest because of her affection for Mulder or her connection to Mulder or whatever it is.
And things she's seen.
Mm-hmm. So how much of that was stuff that you guys had planned right from the beginning, and how much of it was, you know, you guys going, well, we need to have a Beyond the Sea episode to have her, like, buy into this?
My memory is not...
great.
No, but my memory is that we didn't really have that.
You just kind of...
Yeah, you know, nowadays, you know, back then, there was, I don't remember other shows, having a writer's room for drama. It was like a comedy for, and you know, Simpsons were across the way from us, and they had a writer's room, and they, like, threw out jokes and stuff. I didn't have that on Jump Street. We didn't have that. I just didn't have that. Now, and things weren't serialized, so that writer could go off and figure out how the cops are going to catch this guy this week. But we didn't have that. We just kind of went to lunch or hung out here and there, and oh, this would be cool, and that would be cool. And Chris would go, I'm gonna do this. I'm gonna introduce the Deep Throat guy. Okay, and we go off and do that, and Howard and Alex would do that. And once the episodes start coming in, you know, it's. The network at the time, we're all really, really good guys. I'm gonna sound like.
Yeah.
Nothing can mess you up more than a bunch of executives, but you were good guys. Bob Greenblatt, who runs NBC now, and Dan McDermott, and you know, they were good, smart people. But they go like, when do they help people? They should help people every week. And so that's that episode, Shadows, is like, you know, there was a secretary and the ghost and Molly Scully. Like, we took one for the team.
Her dead boss.
Like, right, yeah, it was, you know. So,
wait,
Chris,
you don't like that episode?
Well, you know, I like the Michael Cattleman. He later did episodes of Space Above and Beyond for me, and then I worked with him on the show called The River a couple years ago. And the actors are good and all that, but it's just not what we were out to do. We took one. Jim and I are like, look, we'll do this. Oh, hey, they're going to help, and they go, oh, that's great. But then Howard and Alex and Chris could go
like Highway to Heaven, kind of. Yeah,
exactly right. Yeah, it was horrible. And so there was that way of coming up, and then once you see that, they go, oh, that's not as good as that. That one wasn't really as good as that one.
Yeah.
That's right. That's why we should not do that anymore. Yeah. So that helps. Doesn't help, but that plays a part in guiding how a show's going to go. And then, you know, with Ice, man, and I like those guys. Jim and I had a 45-minute speakerphone screaming thing with them. They didn't want the last act should be out in the world. The parasitic worm thing or whatever it was should.
It's in New York City. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, like King Kong.
How do you end that? You can't end that. And we're like, no, it's contained. That's the whole thing. That's like, Twilight Zone-ish.
Right.
You know, and, you know, we love The Thing. It was like, they did that well.
Yeah.
That's got to keep it there. And they're like, no, no. And then they finally were just like, we hate you. Just go ahead. We'll show you. And then Nutter came in and did a great job. And then they're like, we like more like Ice. So that dictates. And then, you know, it's like, want to help out Scully. So maybe we should do this episode.
Right.
And I think that one of the biggest developments on that show, I mean, I, you know what? I was like busy, I wasn't paying attention. And I saw dailies where Deep Throat got killed. I was like, oh my God.
Oh, you didn't know?
No. Well, you know, we were always like doing our thing.
Yeah.
And Howard and Alex like doing their thing. And we check out what each other was doing. And I thought that was like really what showed like this show will do anything.
Yeah. And I think at that point, the show had gotten into this thing of reusing, of overusing a Deep Throat a little bit.
Right.
He started coming into non-mythology episodes, and it sort of had become a shortcut where it was like, well, how do we get Mulder's information? Let's bring this guy in that knows everything, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So it felt like a good time to do that. And then when Mr. X came in, yeah. I like that he was a different kind of character. He didn't really want to help. Like you get the sense that he maybe used to be like Mulder, and now he's...
He said it.
Yeah, he says it, right? Yeah.
Yeah, I forget which episode, but he goes, I used to be you or something.
Yeah, and now he's really scared. He's always like half in shadow and stuff. So it's a very different dynamic, different kind of dad, you know?
Well, that we knew him from Jump Street, Steve Wayne's
right, of
course. Chapel.
Yes, yeah. That's right. He's great.
He's great. Really good guy.
Yeah, and the guy who plays Deep Throat was really great, too. Jerry Hardin.
Yeah.
Yeah, that guy was really great, too. Yeah. It could have been a part that just is like this fount of information, but then he really brought a lot of humanity to it.
Yeah, he had a coolness.
Yeah.
The Mulder was all amped up, but he had a kind of different balance to it all.
And right.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, you look out. You know, like, Mitch came in. Pledgy came in.
Oh, amazing.
And you go, wow, here you got a guy stays the whole time. And you know what? I heard that too, and I got to admit that we were like, you know, jerks that Toombs, Paul Ben Victor was the therapist.
Uh-huh.
And Paul had no hair.
Uh-huh. Right?
And then we cast a guy in Vancouver who Toombs is going to get. He had no hair. I'm like, this episode is the all bald episode. So when Mitch came in, like, that guy. Yeah, I mean, it's good, of course.
But, right. But that's amazing. Like, the decisions are made on these sort of, you know, in the moment it just feels like arbitrary kind of, you know.
It's here forever.
It's interesting. Like, you know, I go on auditions and stuff and I don't get it. And it's like, why did I not get it? What is it? And sometimes it's like, man, he wasn't the right height or something, you know.
Well, you know, this is like one of my, on the whole time there. And when we were casting, when we did Squeeze, I was in Chris's office at the time, and I think Chris was away. I think he was doing the second episode. It was Jim and I and the director, Harry Longstreet, who we were not getting along.
Yeah.
Which, you know, we didn't hit it off, Jim and I, and this guy.
This is Toombs?
Squeeze.
Squeeze.
And we're having people come in audition for Toombs.
Yeah.
And, you know, guys would come in, and like I said, they were guys that, there was no show like that. And so the actors are programmed to come in and try to get the part on the CBS show.
Right.
And so the audition piece was the polygraph test.
Right.
Which we chose because that should be, you're supposed to give it as, the answers as flat as possible in one word.
Right.
Things. But, you know, these poor guys would come in and go, you know, is your name Eugene Toombs? And they'd go, yes. It was torture.
And swinging for the fences.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly. And the director would, at the end of their audition, he'd say, okay, now I want you to go from a neutral to an attack thing. And they'd go, okay, and they'd go, mwah. It was just and Jim and I would go, don't do that. It's embarrassing. Don't do that. And he's like, blah, 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 blah. And,
they're just sitting in a chair pretending
yeah, just,
to,
just like
attack.
This, like,
yeah.
You know, just a blank face to
yeah.
A, like, I'm like a drunk uncle at Halloween.
Oh,
you know?
God.
And so Doug walked in, and it was that thing. I know actors hate to hear this, but it is, you can't help it. As he walked in, I went, oh, that guy's too old.
Yeah.
And by the time he sat down, I went, oh, this guy's too young. I mean, he transformed.
Yeah.
From those five steps to the chair. And then, you know, Doug, he didn't know him at all. He just sat there. Yes. I go, okay, you ready? You got any questions? She goes, questions? Am I getting over the thing? No. Is your name Eugene Toombs? And you go, yes. Did you do this or did you do that? You whatever. And he's like, no. And he was really, really giving me the creeps.
Yeah.
I'm like, I kind of like this, but he just seemed like a lunatic.
Yeah.
And so at the end of the thing, the director says, okay, can you go from a neutral to attack position? And Doug goes, what? Because a neutral from attack position, we'd like to see that. Because I don't understand what you're saying to me. And now we're going, what a kook. And he goes, well, you know, you play a serial killer. And so we need to see, you know, you're going to be, you know, yeah, at the camera. And Doug goes, wait, I play a serial killer? And I don't, and you want me to go from a neutral to an attack position? Is that what you're saying, motherfucker? And he's just like, we're going, holy, oh my God. And then I'm like, realize, oh.
He's doing
I've
it.
I've been duped.
Yeah.
And he's got the part. And then when he left, the director's like, no way. He embarrassed us. I'm like, no, you're losing this one. And, but that was like, if I, you know, if you had, or if I had in gym and stuck with our initial, no. When
yeah.
you walked in the door, you wouldn't have had this great character.
Yeah, and he was great because, do you know him personally still? Because he's had some interesting
yeah.
stuff happen.
Less so lately.
Yeah, but that's an interesting thing because he's a guy who, you know, his creepiness or whatever, that actor is a certain way and he brings so much of that role. No one else could have played it like that.
No.
Yeah, and I mean, he became the first recurring. What was the idea behind that? Because that was, you know, on the message boards, very popular character.
Mm-hmm.
So was that something that you guys had planned? Like, all right, some of these are going to be recurring guys, or were you just like, oh, that guy was great, let's just bring him back?
Yeah, you know, you're asking like, how does it come about? I think, you know, Chris is like, I know the second show.
Yeah,
I know what I'm going to do. It's going to be a UFO show. That would be the extent of it. My memory.
Yeah.
Like, all right, and then because we knew Peter Roth. The network was very concerned about it just being UFO of the week. And so
they wanted that?
They did not.
They did not.
And so Jim and I were assigned to how do you not do another UFO show?
Right.
And we were, because of our rank, I think Howard and Alex are supervising and we were co-execs, we were next in line.
Right.
So our job was to think of a monster. And we were in a, Jim and I had an office over there, which is like about like this.
Yeah.
It's just a box. And it was later at night. And Jim goes, what if a guy came through that air vent? I go, that'd be cool. And it just starts from there. And, you know, you had to go to the network and you have to pitch ideas. And they're like, yeah, okay. And so they were always, like, pretty on board with doing a
monster
show.
Yeah. Oh, so it wasn't that you guys had to go pitch the bad guys to them? You guys had to pitch the premise
of
every show?
Any series, the first six episodes, you have to...
Right.
So, okay, the first one's going to be a UFO, and we're going to introduce Deep Throat, and this is going to happen, and that's going to happen. Okay, now, okay, well, we're going to have this guy. And this is like, it was kind of weird. But you're in a room, and you see the screws go, and,
yeah.
And you know, and this guy's dead, and you got this guy who comes out and hunts livers or whatever
yeah.
you say. And they're just like, okay.
Yeah.
And I forget what, I think Howard and Alex, their first idea was about an abortion clinic. Okay, you guys go after us because yours will be rejected. You have no chance in hell.
Yeah,
that's
not going to happen.
Yeah, that's what happened.
What's the abortion? Are there like evil fetuses running around?
Well, no, it was like creepy stuff. We were all having kids, and so you all have that thing where you go into the ultrasound. It's kind of weird.
Uh-huh.
And we're like, you know, we're always trying to tap into what...
Your experiences.
Yeah, you went right.
Yeah, and so what? Like you know, I've talked about it on the show, and you mentioned there was nothing else like it. Nothing else. Now, there's I guess some shows that do that sort of serialized thing with sort of one-offs. So was that the plan right from the beginning? Was this going to be an overarching storyline? Because I realized watching it, the end of season one, in my head, all the mythology alien episodes sort of work together. But they're mostly standalones until right. the end of season one. It seems like at some point, watching it seems like a decision was made like, all right, let's sort of connect all these dots. That'll be the big thing, and then all these little things will happen. How much of that was planned
well,
for
you? Well, I think I was looking at a box set years ago, and I was like, oh, wow, I think there's only four or five mythology shows in the first season.
Yeah.
If that. And I think it became a mythology show hardcore when Jillian got pregnant.
Right.
And you had to, okay, figure out how to put her on the bench.
Yeah, Dwayne Barry and Ascension. Great episodes, yeah.
Yeah, or, you know, one breath, she just lies in bed. I mean, I think she had her kid like a couple days before or something.
I noticed, well, someone who had, I haven't released that one, but I talked to Rhea and she mentioned that when she's on the boat, in her dream sequence, there's a pillow behind her. She's like, well, that wouldn't happen in the dream. That was just the actress like, I just had a fucking baby. Can we put a pillow here?
That thing where she's laying on the slab and her dad comes to talk to her. I mean, her breasts are ginormous.
Yes.
I was like, oh, you know, nowadays somebody would have like not painted them out, but it was, you know.
Yeah, it's very distracting.
Very distracting.
I'll tell you, after that, the next 4 weeks in the message boards are just about her breasts. It's about a lot about her breasts, and people fighting against the people about her breasts, and then people fighting the people fighting the people about the breasts.
All right.
It really became the internet on the strength of her breasts.
Now, I remember watching dailies where we were going, oh.
Yeah.
I should get around that. It's distracting.
Well, that episode is really good. It's not even really, nothing really supernatural happens in that episode. It's just a very emotional episode. And, you know, I talk about it in the episode, but I've had sort of an experience where a loved one was very sick, was in a coma, and the feelings that Mulder has, what I really connected to in that episode was the sense that, you know, Mulder's not a doctor. He can't do anything about this. So he's running around trying to, like, you know, do other stuff and yelling at people. And he's getting really frustrated. He's got to get it out in some way. I remember when my, she's now my wife. When she was really sick, it was just like me and her dad going to, like, fix her tires or, you know, getting new curtains for her. Like, you do what you can. And I think I really connected to that. How did you guys sort of work out the emotionality of that episode? Was that based on, like, personal experience? Because it really felt very, very real.
Well, Jim and I had that, too. We had a guy that we went to college with. His name was Ed Palacios, and he had a car accident in, like, Inglewood and 405. And it was, like, one of those things where you're used to television. And when you go in either to court or to the hospital, and you go, whoa, what is this?
Yeah.
TV tells me it's that. And so, you know, yeah. Seeing Ed in that condition, and just that he's kind of there, but he's not.
Right.
You know, I know that I say I'm skeptical, but in that situation, you're like, he's here, but he's not. And I was just trying to explore that idea. And you know what? I'm really upset with myself. I can't remember the name. There was a book that was written by a surgeon.
Oh, about his coma dreams.
Right. And he had Alzheimer's. He had Legionnaire's disease and just fell into a coma. And this book is outstanding. And it was like very much about consciousness that in the coma, sometimes like right here, he heard people in the room talking and he wanted to go, no, I'm here.
Yeah.
But then, boom, he would fall back to some dark place that he would, like had no idea how to get back to where he just was, and it was just really fascinating. And that's not, to me, necessarily a paranormal situation. So, you know, you take that, and what you need, you know, wanted to show that Mulder, you know, had feelings towards her. So you'd try to, you know, I think sometimes when you work out a story, you go, Mulder's feelings towards Scully, you know, that's the first thing you put up.
Really?
And, you know, what we always worked on, you know, you'd get a board.
Yeah.
And you'd go out and get 3x5 cards. And, you know, back then it was a teaser and 4x. And then you wrote down, Mulder cries.
Yeah.
And you stick it in the board. And then you didn't have to write outlines then. We had a executive, Ken Horton, would come down to the office. And all the cards would be laid out. There's a story. And you go, oh, this should go here. And this should go there. So you just wanted to show what you meant to him. And also, you said it too, you have a show and you can have like monsters and ugliness and the paranormal, like vampires sucking your blood and all this like dark shit. And it's not all that, you know. And so his choice to not shoot those guys, and, you know, her Scully's sister says it, like, just because it's you know, good or doesn't make it trite and stupid. So right. I think we're trying to get that across as well.
Yeah, that was a big thing because all Mulder believes in the supernatural, but all the dark stuff. And she's like, you know, there's like positive forces that right. we don't understand also. I thought right. that was really interesting.
Well, you know, you're just a one-note show if that's...
Right. You know. That's a very interesting that you said that you'd always start with like how Mulder feels about Scully. Like every episode and that sort of building on that very emotional base is why those...
Right.
You know, it's not just a show about people drinking blood or whatever. Another interesting thing in that episode is that it's very hard to sort of... do anything cinematic with a coma. It's just a person laying there. You guys did such a great job with the boat and the tether to the
right.
to the you know to the shore and the you know the dad coming into that room and stuff. How did you guys get that idea? I thought that to me emotionally, you know, I used to be like I would see people talking to people in comas and stuff. I'm like, that's bullshit. But when right. Emily was in a coma, she had those stories of weird dreams and she had. In her head, built this. When she finally woke up, she's sort of there, sort of not there. You know, she's in a coma for 10 days, and then she was like, "So like, how are you? Are you better?" And I'm like, "I'm fine. What do you mean?" So in her head, the story was that I was the one who was sick. So she could kind of hear. She kind of knew that that she was at a hospital.
Wow.
But yeah, and so the same thing, it felt so real to me that Scully sort of sees her family there on the shore. That really was Emily's experience. One of the weird things I talk about in the podcast when it comes up is that she says one of the doctors was sticky candy hands, and it was because they had all these, you know, they would put tape on her to like, you know, yeah. for needles and stuff.
Yeah.
So some part of her was feeling that yeah, and had like written that into the story. Her brain had like made a story like, oh, right, these right. doctors have sticky candy hands because they, mm-hmm. you know, when they would touch her, they'd be putting tape on her and stuff. Wow. But I thought that stuff, as someone who's been through that experience, it all rang so true to me. And it also works story-wise. And I thought that shot, it's such a great shot, where it's the first time you see sort of Scully's perspective. The camera's like at the head of the bed, staring out, and she's in like sort of the coma world, and then slowly transitions to the hospital. What a beautiful cinematic way to show somebody.
I was looking at that. I know it's green screen Bob Goodwin, but that's like Rosemary's Baby.
Oh, is it?
In Rosemary's Baby, they have that, like, she's on the bed, and then it's floating, and then, I don't know if we said, let's do Rosemary's Baby, but it was like, oh, well, that's just like that shot in Rosemary's Baby.
But it's so good, and it really, like, conveys someone waking up so well, and that moment when Mulder comes in and talks to her, and when he talks to her, it's like 20 seconds, he's like, I just want to make sure you're okay or something, and he walks out. But it was, that whole episode was built up to that moment of them talking to each other so much that really, like, got me teary-eyed. Just him talking to her, like, about really nothing, like, oh, I'm glad to see you're awake. That moment was so strong.
Thanks. You know, that's all them. That's, you know, that's pretty powerful, you just told me about it. I mean,
you did a great job.
No, but you know, I mean, I used to faint at sight of blood and stuff.
Yeah.
And I had that in that moment where you hit the floor, and it's like a dream. You just have a really crazy, and then you start to hear the people's like, "Oh, he fainted," and then you go, "Oh no, I'm not having that," and so I can have a hunch as to what that is.
Yeah.
But I don't know. It's just trying to, you know, what your wife went through or what that surgeon went through is to go, I'm putting it down there. And then a lot of people are going to come back and go, yeah, that happened to me. That was always the greatest compliment. If anyone said, I had that.
Yeah.
Or I was afraid of that. You know, that's like you go, hey, I see life this way. Do you?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, and that's what making art is, right? It's just trying to connect to people's all kinds of different experiences, like the shared, you know, humanity we have. I thought a couple other things I just wanted to mention. I thought the last scene of the first season where he called Scully to tell her that the X-Files is shut down, to me, and she's so devastated by it. What a journey she's taken from episode one to this one, where like X-Files is kind of a, you know, it's like a shit gig, right? It's like, it's not a punishment, but it's like nothing down here but the FBI is most unwanted, right? And that's why she's, and then by the end to be so bought into this this crusade that he has. But she's not buying into everything he's doing, but she knows something's up, someone's trying to do something. And you guys did such a great job of, like, giving her that arc in a very believable way, and also, like, having her really get invested emotionally in Mulder and what he's doing so well.
Well, you know, I really think that that's, yeah, that's just so much Chris. You'd go, no, this is now. Let's do this now. No, we're not doing that now. We're doing that later. And, you know, he was up in Vancouver, you know, most of the time, and could come back and go, oh, you know, it would be a good idea, this and that. And
were you guys in L.A.?
Yeah, we would write in L.A. and edit in L.A. And then usually you'd go up to prep your episode. So I wasn't around for shooting a lot of our episodes. I was there when they were shooting Howard or Alex or Chris's episode.
Wow. Yeah. And was that something from the beginning that you guys have been like, because it seems to me what's great about the show, watching it, you sort of understand too, is that you guys kind of rolled with the punches. Like, obviously her pregnancy becomes a major part of the show. It's not that you guys sat down and were like, this is what the show's going to be. Let's follow this blueprint. It feels like you guys sort of went on feeling like, this is where it should go. This is how we're feeling, you know, get beyond the sea in earlier, get her bought into this. Was that always the plan to have The X-Files shut down at the end of season one? And
No, she got pregnant.
Really?
And I think, I was thinking about it, and because I think that thing at Tomb is like, oh, there's going to be changes. We must have known she was.
Right.
And we said, we'll shut it down.
Yeah.
Which, you know, having grown up in at Stephen Cannell, who is like old time as you can get, or Peter Roth, what you did then was the second year, you just did the first year again.
Ah.
And the hardest year for a series was the third year, because then it was going to get boring.
Right.
If you did one or two, and that's when you shook it up. So we were going in saying, we're going to shake it up the second year.
Yeah.
Like, nah. But you had no choice. So, but I think that's the thing, from what I read, I'm not on other shows, but I believe that, you know, I think Vince wanted to kill, the plan was to kill Jesse Pinkman after four episodes, or, you know, there's a tax break to go film in New Mexico.
Yeah.
And so there's these lucky accidents that you have to acknowledge, or Nancy Marquand dying. The Sopranos moved from Tony Soprano and his mother. And there's just accidents that happen along the way when you're lucky and you just have to deal with them. And very often there's the best parts of your show. You can't say, I thought this up and I did it. It's just these, you know, acts of fate come in.
Yeah, I mean, I'm on this show called Silicon Valley on HBO, and our sort of the guy who's the money guy, the boss guy, that actor passed away while we were shooting.
I'm not aware of that.
Really good. Have you seen?
Yeah, of course, yeah.
How much have you seen of it? So Peter Gregory, the guy who's like the Sesame Seeds guy?
Yeah, yeah.
So if you notice, he's only in the first five, then he's not there. He passed away while we were shooting episode 6.
Oh, because I was wondering why. Okay, I see.
So he's gone. We sort of, you know, in the moment, they just had to scramble just a schedule. Like, we did reshoots the next year to sort of fill in some gaps. But he passed away. So now season 2, most of it is going to end up sort of being dealing with him not being there, you know. And that becomes a major part of the story, because he's such a big part of the story. You can't be like, all right, he's just not around, we'll figure it out. Him not being around is sort of the fallout of that, is the whole of season 2. So, like you said, it's you sort of use, you know, whatever happens, it's a tragedy,
Man, I'm really sorry.
Yeah, no, it was a pretty very, very stressful, very, very stressful thing. He was so wonderful in that role.
Yeah,
He's so funny and so real and so human in it. It's devastating.
I'm not going to have this guy back. He's depressing.
No. No. This is great. I'd love to have you back, because one of my favorite episodes is Home. I know that's one of the most controversial episodes, too. Mm-hmm. And we'll get into that in a second, but the other thing I want to say, season 2, episode 1, Little Green Men. I really love this episode, because to me, what's really heartbreaking is seeing that Mulder and Scully are disconnected. And it's such a testament to what the show became, which is the two of them together. That is the show. They could be going to get, you know, coffee. And to me, it's the X-Files. To me, it's not the X-Files if they're not in it, you know. Mm-hmm. And to start the next season with them so completely disconnected, where she really, there's almost something maternal about her trying to, like, take care of Mulder. She, like, you know, runs her finger through his hair at one point in, like, a very, like he's a little boy kind of way. To me, that was so devastating. And then sort of getting them to reconnect, you know, he sort of goes on his weird, he goes to that observatory or whatever, and he's alone there. And that's such a great, like, visualization of his, of how he sees himself in that moment where he's, like, alone in this crazy quest and no one's with him and the only guy is there. He can't understand, you know. But I think that episode did such a great job of, like, reestablishing his mindset, Mulder's mindset, sort of giving him purpose again to go after, you know, the things he believes and then also reconnecting them. Was that always the plan that you guys would like, that they'd sort of, after, I guess, the X-Files is done, like, separating them, having them be on, like, different assignments and stuff? Like, I guess that sort of comes naturally from...
Well, because she's pregnant.
That's amazing, because she's pregnant.
No, and then, you know, I think over the summer, or we said, or the last few episodes of the first season... She can't run around.
Right.
So, hey, I know. Why don't we... She's missing. And
we'll put her on a boat with a pillow.
Yeah. It was like really red, all embroidered.
Yeah. No, you guys had to find a great pillow.
Heaven makes nice pillows.
Yeah. It's like the pillow of the imagination. This is the best pillow. Yeah. You can't buy this pillow.
Yeah, some guy probably had to go, like, Goodwin was like, no, not that pillow, that pillow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that's just so much of it. You can't have them together. And so probably, you know, it becomes math. Like, when is she ever a kid? Okay, so we could use her in bed for a day.
Yeah.
If she has a kid at the right time. And then she'll be, you know, a week off, and then she'll be back to work. So these first, whatever it was, five or six episodes have to be their own little arc. And then you can get back into...
The X-Files.
Right, but then those... that story that becomes mandated by her pregnancy, they've developed... And so you just can't fall back into what it was the first year. The characters have moved on. So that was just all, you know, there's a lot of luck to that.
Right. I mean, there's, you know, there's the stuff that happens, but the way you guys sort of deal with it is what's interesting. Like, after Dwayne Barry in Ascension, which is sort of how, you know, they write, you guys wrote her going away and then a couple episodes later coming back. That changes the show. It changes Scully, and the effects of that are felt through the rest of the series. I mean, her pregnancy changes the show forever.
Right.
In a very, I think what it does is it does a really good job of, you know, she's a skeptic, and now she's been abducted and she's gone through some crazy shit. It does a great job of, like, giving her purpose and giving her stakes in the quest.
And there's no, it was totally Jillian getting pregnant. None of us, when we went to lunch, we hung out in the office, I got an idea. Let's separate them. Let's really mess up what we got going.
Right. No one would
no
be
one
like
would
that.
Have, no one would
yeah, this is
that.
A terrible idea. What are you talking about? Yeah.
Get out. Get rid of that guy.
And you see how hard it is, the one episode where she's not around at all. Three with the vampires.
Right. Yep.
That's you see how hard it is to do the X-Files with just Mulder around.
Well, no, I can, you know, I really TV, it's all about the people.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of shows that kind of whatever ripped off the X-Files or tried to do a conspiracy.
Oh, sure.
They did not have Dave and Jillian. They were never going to work because you didn't have David and Jillian and Mulder and Scully. And that show is like, you know, they're great writers and came up with some weird shit. But without them, you don't want to go through that.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, TV, like you said, it's all the... I mean, if you think of Seinfeld, it's just
That's
the
right.
cast. Friends, there's not even a premise. The premise is the title of the show.
Right.
These six people are friends. You want to hang out with them because they're great together.
That's right. Yeah. Right.
But then what was cool about your show is that you start with the base of, you know, you want to be hanging out with these people and then build such a big, huge mythology around it. And so then you guys did the first two seasons. Did it feel like when you were doing season one, you know, the jump from season one to season two in terms of your viewership and in terms of, I know there was a TV Guide cover between seasons one and two when the show's not even
on. When it meant something.
That's right. Now nobody has TV Guides anymore.
Well, they're big now.
Yeah. Oh, I haven't. They are they?
They've been that way for a while. They're like regular magazine. You know,
oh.
They should be that.
Because the listings, nobody cares about anymore. No. It's all online. So now it's, I guess it's like Entertainment Weekly or something. So, so it's, the while you were doing season one, I know that, you know, so you're sort of doing your thing and you kind of, in a way, don't want to think about, are people going to watch this? I hope people watch this, all that stuff. You don't really think about that. But did you feel like you were making, when you were making season one, was there ever like, oh man, I feel like we're really doing something here? Or did it just feel like you're just doing your job and you're doing the best you can? The big picture stuff is not even in your head.
It was nuts.
Yeah.
Bob Goodwin would call the line producer, as you call the, he would call me once a week on his way home to Bellingham, Washington. I quit. Hell with this. You know, up in Vancouver, and it was like, and you know, I mean, you know, Howard, I love Howard. He's very neurotic. And
I know.
I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know. I get the show. And like, and then it was just crazy.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then the network going, what are you doing? And, you know, and then the head of the network would say things like, the real hit's going to be The Adventures of Briscoe County. And you'd be like, oh, hey.
Hey, we're here.
We're here. Right?
Yeah,
exactly.
We're right here.
Yeah, well, after you're canceled, there was stuff like that. And you'd read like,
really?
Like weekly, like, yeah, goodbye with this show. And you're like, and, you know, we all were, yeah, so the point, it was just crazy. I mean, I guess you forget that now, but it was just nuts. And a lot of times, and it wasn't, we didn't have Bowman, Kim, and Nutter. They were there. But when you have those guys, and they can do 3 or 4 episodes a year, you're taken care of.
Right.
So when you have a show that's not, you know, if you're doing a lawyer show, a new lawyer show, you can go, it's like that lawyer show.
Right.
I want the shots and everything to be like that.
Right.
We had a lot of locations. We had scary lighting.
Oh, yeah, the show had its own, like, visual language, like the way...
No one else had.
And I didn't even realize that. I mean, I've been a big fan of the show, but this is the most critically I've ever thought of the show until I watched the Simpsons episode where they're, like, you know, all doing all those weird camera angles. I was like, oh, yeah, that is what the X-Files looks like.
Yeah.
With, the, like, purple light coming in through a window. I talked about that in one of the episodes. Yeah. But it had its own, like, visual... you know, language, and those directors were so good. Like, I remember, I forget what the first Bowman episode was, and then he eventually directed the movie.
Yeah.
But seeing that, I was like, oh, this is really great. Nutter always does a great job.
Yeah, and then, you know, Nutter and Kim, well, Bowman, those three all started at Cannell. Bowman started doing inserts and stuff, and Kim was a little bit of the whipping boy over there. He'd always get, like, the less than good pilots to do, and then he'd get the blame.
Yeah.
And when we went over there, we said, oh, we want these guys. We didn't know Rob as well, but we got Nutter and Kim. And Bob, who was setting a lot of those directors, was resistant because of that Cannell old school reputation. And I think to shut us up, they put Nutter in for Ice. And Nutter just does, no one prepares like Dave Nutter. And he just nailed it. I've never had a director's cut come in where I'm like, okay, I have nothing to do.
That's good. Done.
Send it. And so because Nutter did a good job, somebody fell out on the hand of Erwitz and were like, Kim. And because Nutter had come through for us, they got Kim. And the next week they made him a producer. And Kim was really driven to show, like, I'm good. I'm a good director. I know how to do this, you know.
And then Kim worked on Breaking Bad later and then passed away not too long ago, right? Kim
he worked on Supernatural for most, and he passed away, 4 or 5 years ago.
Yeah, it's interesting to see so many of the same names from later in the season on Breaking Bad, like John Scheiben. Yeah, however you say it, obviously.
And Michelle McLaren, who directed some of the great episodes. She was up there. She produced the movie too. I mean, you know.
Oh, the first movie.
I think the second one.
Okay. Yeah. And then, so you guys, when you were doing season two, did it feel like it was catching on or something? Did it feel like... Because, I mean, you worked on a show that is 20 years... I mean, it's still around. They're still talking about doing another movie.
Yeah.
You know, it's... And I feel like right now it's sort of becoming... It's coming back into the conversation in a fun way. Did it feel like you were doing something like that or are you just working on a show?
No. We really... That goes to... I didn't answer your question well, but that we were just doing it for us.
Yeah.
Like, oh, I'd like to see this. I'd like to see...
Guy coming through a crate.
Yeah, I'd like to see that. And, you know what would be cool? The Hand of Erwitz. I had watched, every of us see National Geographic and a snake eats a cow.
Yeah.
Like, hey, we got to do that scene, but it's got to eat a guy.
Yeah.
Okay. And then I was just like floating around. And they go, hey, Howard, you got to do this thing where a snake eats a guy. And Howard goes off and he comes back weeks or a month later. He goes, I don't, that doesn't make sense. I can't make that. So, fuck you, Howard. We're going to do this. So it's just like right on a card. Snake eats a guy. And I'm holding it. And where does it go? And Jim goes, end of act three. And you go, just so you can see that.
Yeah, that's what you're getting to.
Yeah, right. And so you just go, all right, we're just doing this thing that you're trying to make ourselves get a kick out of it. And Jim and I left midway through the second year to go do Space Above and Beyond.
Yeah, that episode, I believe, was your last one of season
two.
I haven't gotten to that one yet.
Right. And when we did Space, I think that's when they moved to Sunday. And it became huge.
Uh-huh.
When we weren't there, I'm like, damn.
But then you guys came back season four.
That's right. But we were only going to do four episodes. And we worked on Millennium at the same time.
Season four was the first season of Millennium.
Right.
And that's another Chris Carter show, obviously.
Yep.
And you guys did Home. What were the other ones you guys did in season four? Do you remember?
The Diary of whatever it was called. Musings of a Cancer.
Yeah. The Forrest
Where
Gump.
I Died.
Yeah.
And Never Again.
Yeah. Which one was Never Again?
The Tattoo.
Oh, yeah.
Jody.
Oh, yeah. And then are you guys around for season five as well?
Nope.
So
we did a fourth year, and then after that, like a fourth year, I kind of focused on those four, and Jim did a lot of Millennium.
Yeah.
And then the second year, we just ran Millennium.
Okay. And then how did your brother get involved in it? He wrote, a bunch of he wrote sort of the funny, weird ones.
I was looking at Blood and I was going, what was Darren's thing about this?
Well, I read and it said that Darren was running once and he found, because, they released these like irradiated, to control populations, sterile bugs. And
in California, they used to fly around with helicopters and spray back around that time, and I can't remember the chemical.
Yeah, I mean, those images of them just spraying kids in a pool with DDT.
Right, yeah.
Now, to me, I don't know, when I watched it, I laughed so hard. I was like, what
are
they?
It's real footage, though.
These kids look so happy.
Yeah.
Like, even then, you should be like, something is wrong. When cigarettes, when doctors are like, cigarettes are good. Like, really, I'm sucking fire into my lungs.
Yeah.
There has to be something wrong with this.
It doesn't make me feel good.
Yeah, exactly. I feel lightheaded.
Maybe they're tricking me.
Yeah, I cough.
Right.
My body is fighting it.
Yeah.
I think that was such a great thing. At its best, to me, X-Files, obviously it's the relationship of the two, but what it does a real good job is connecting it to real life stuff.
Right.
The paranoia. I mean, our government, the idea, you think of the U.S. government as being this thing, like, force for good, we do the right thing, and then you find out, like, well, what about the Tuskegee Airmen? What about DDT? Like, all this crazy stuff that was happening, and you guys sort of took that, the real stuff, and then sort of extrapolated from that in a way that felt very real, felt very realistic, and it felt very... I was looking at, in one of the episodes, I talk about, like, the U.S. mistrust of the government,
mm-hmm.
and early X-Files, 93, 94, 95, it's like an all-time low. So it's sort of, you guys hit at a time when that was something that was really in the air.
I think about it, and I don't have the answer, but, and to the horror sci-fi genre is usually ahead of things.
Yeah.
That even Godzilla was talking about the nuclear war before anybody else was, or, Invasion of the Body Snatchers talking about McCarthy era, or Rosemary's Baby about the coming... That was like really the first great conspiracy movie.
Yeah.
And I didn't know. That show came after Reagan.
Yeah.
But really before now.
Yeah.
I mean, all the stuff that's going on this week in Missouri to me is like just been building up because no one really does.
No one did anything and it needed like one inciting incident.
Right. So I'm like, is that show a response to something? Or were we
ahead of the curve?
Just and feeling and you know what I think the other thing that helps that show be ahead is there was only AOL. There's no internet to go to disprove you or or to immediately get on Snopes and go, oh, that's bullshit. You know what I mean?
So the people sense could go that out it there might,
yeah.
I think that's real.
Well, what I would always did is I'd get like Science News, which was a pamphlet, came every Monday. And you just do other research. You're out in the world, and you'd have like, they had really dug however many feet into the Arctic and pulled out an ice core, and all this stuff had been frozen for 250,000 years. Like, oh, that happened this week. And then you had some other thing you would learn about a worm, and you'd make shit up in the middle.
Yeah, to connect it.
And people would inevitably go, oh, yeah, I heard of that.
Yeah. Which,
you know.
This. Enough real stuff in there. You guys use that as a jumping point in a really, really great way. Because, I mean, the thing with ice, to me, that worm that, like, makes, more aggressive and stuff, it's completely believable. It's not really hard sci-fi, that episode. That episode's, like, fairly... And then later, there's another episode. I forget which one it is. But, you know, there's, like, a thing that like can control ants, you know, like get into ants' heads move them around, and you know that's sort of Firewalker is the episode where that happens. It's sort of like pretty similar to ice in a lot of ways,
right?
But yeah, and to me, you guys did such a great job of, you know, you have these characters that you really care about, but then in connecting it to our world and sort of feeding into, I think, a kind of paranoia, or at least mistrust or distrust, that I think is very healthy, that I think is important. I mean, you don't want to be a crazy conspiracy guy, but, I mean, they've been listening to our phone calls and tapping, you know, reading all our emails for years and years.
Yeah.
I mean, the fact that, I forget the name of the person, but, you know, there was like a bombing in, I think, Afghanistan, where, like, all these civilians died. All these civilians were killed, and they covered it up. And then the person who pointed that out is in jail. The people who killed those people are out and haven't even lost their jobs.
Yeah.
The person who said, hey, this crazy shit happened, that's the person in jail. I mean, that's X-Files stuff.
Well, you know, I guess it probably is, you know, Orwell and those guys like that who said this stuff's coming, and no one, they thought, oh, that's cute. It's coming 30 or 40 years from now, but it was happening then. And, you know, once you have a show like that, people just start offering it. You know, at first, you have to go out and do research.
Yeah.
And then after it's been on a while, you start bringing, people are bringing weird stuff. You know what I know?
Yeah.
What? You know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I had Dean Haglund on, Lone Gunman, and he talked about how he saw this one truck that was like this huge armored crazy truck where they were like hiding something on it. And like they're like cop cars all around it and stuff, and they're driving on the highway, you know, 2 a.m. and he's like, what the fuck is on that thing? Like, what is on that thing? To me, that one episode, I believe it's EBE. I think Howard Gordon and Alex Ganser wrote it. I think.
Yeah, we wrote that one, but I'm not going to be able to remember what
you guys wrote. EBE?
Yeah.
Is that the one with the with the truck that has the alien life form in it, and at the end, then Deep Throat is like, I'm one of three people who's killed in EBE.
Yeah.
That's such a great episode, because to me, X-Files is at its best when it changes my world a little bit. And now whenever I see a big truck driving down the highway, I always look at it differently, because there's that sense, and that episode does such a great job of like Mulder is like, the truth is in that truck. I just have to get to that fucking truck, you know? And it's just like sort of a... just driving across America, and he's trying to track down this truck, and it's taking like a huge, big, crazy idea, making it very small, putting it on a truck, and you just have to get to the truck.
Yeah, I think when Jim and I started this place, Sandy Howard, and we come across an article where they transported nuclear triggers in 18-wheelers, and that was like, if they were hijacked, you know, so you just remember, what a great idea, and then whatever, 10, 15 years later, you go, oh, I know where we could do that.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's what it is. Like, I guess writing, like, you have these sort of weird floating around ideas and just looking for a home. And at some point, you're like, all right, this clicks perfectly here. Let's put that guy eats snake. Let's put that act three here.
Guy eats a snake.
Yeah. Snake, I mean, snake eats
snake,
a,
snake eats a guy. Don't get it. Don't mess it up.
I'm sorry. Really, I mean, it's such a wonderful show, and I was so thrilled that you were responding to me on Twitter. It's a show that holds up so well. Like, you know, all the people who are finding the show now, because you guys use special effects in such an sparingly.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a show that, you know, I mean, you watch the old Star Trek, you have to like really ignore all the fucking bright blue green lasers and shit. But X-Files isn't like that at all.
It's well, there is the, I was looking at the hand of Erlitz and she's like, I found this on the internet. And they go to the reverse and it's all DOS. She's got this little laptop.
Yeah, but know. I mean, but that's how it was. I mean, you know, you guys, there's no way for you guys have to put OS 10 in there, you know? Yeah, if you had well, someone using an iPad, you'd be like, wait, what
is
that?
Now I watch Taxi Driver and I'm like, they're all on electric typewriters.
Yeah.
There's no cell phones. They have vinyl records. You know, wasn't that long ago.
Thank you so much for coming and talking to me. This has been awesome. I know people are going to love it. And thank you for, you know, working on
this. I really like Silicon Valley. I really like your work there. I'm really sorry to hear that. And, you know, it's my pleasure.
Oh, thank you.
All right, so that was Glenn Morgan. What really jumped out at me, again, talking to him, was the same thing that I thought of while I was talking to Mark Snow, and that is, you know, in your head, you build up these things of how these, you know, the way that these guys came up with amazing ideas and stuff. And really, a lot of it was, he said, stuff that they wanted to see, which I think is such a great lesson to learn, like, do the stuff you would be a fan of yourself. And that's a great gauge because, you know, you obviously have good taste. You like what you like. Try and make stuff that you like. Make stuff for yourself. And hopefully it's going to be stuff that other people are also going to react to, have a good reaction to. The other thing I learned was how much of The X-Files came out of necessity. You know, they Gillian Anderson was pregnant. They needed to come up with a reason to write her out for a few episodes. And they were like, well, we're going to have to come up with a long story that spans over a bunch of episodes. And that really is how X-Files became a serialized show. The myth arc of the X-Files really happened out of a need to do it, out of circumstance. And then it sort of came to define the series, obviously. So I thought that was really, really fascinating as well. Another thing that's really, really cool is Glenn actually gave me a really, really fantastic present. He gave me index cards from the field where I died. So basically, people who don't know, what's really common is when you're writing an episode in a room, you, on index cards, you write like basically every single scene. You just call it what it is. You just title it like Mulder and Scully discuss the case or whatever it is. And then on a big soft board, you lay out all the scenes together. So it'll be like act one and then like three or four scenes or however many it is, act two, and then a bunch of scenes. So he brought me the actual index cards that they used in the room when they were writing this episode. And there's little like notes on them that Glenn had written in pencil. Like, I like this. I don't like this. This. What really, really got me was that all the index cards have little holes for the thumbtacks. The thumbtacks when they put them up. And, you know, part of me was like, hey, I want to get him to sign it. But I was like, no, I want them to be exactly the way they were. And after the, or during the Mark Snow episode, I talked about, you know, totems or how I think objects have power or value. And a lot of it is, you know, how you see them, your connection to, you know, the memory you had of what you did with these objects. And I don't know, when I look at these, I think of them 20 years ago in a room trying to actually figure out these episodes. I think of that, you know, so it honestly, I was shocked. I was like, wait, you really want me to have these? And he just gave them to me. So I'm going to have them framed or something. I was just really, really touched and blown away. Maybe the best gift I've ever received in my life. I mean, it probably is. Because, you know, obviously I love X-Files paraphernalia and stuff, but something that was actually involved in the making of the show, I really have no words for it. So thank you to Glenn for talking to me and for giving me that wonderful, 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 wonderful gift. Again, apologize, guys. The episode with Matt, we've lost it. It's gone. There's no way it's coming back. Red Museum and the other one is Firewalker. They're gone. That discussion is gone. I don't want to try and recreate it. So next week, I'll sort of discuss those episodes. We'll put out the Kevin Smith episode. We'll attach Excelsis Day to it. So I really, really apologize. I know a lot of people watch these episodes in preparation for this week's podcast. It's just one of those unavoidable things. And what also sucks is I'm away, and I've been away for about a month. And if I was at home, if I was with Emily, I would have been like, hey, Emily, just watch these episodes. Let's just talk about these again. But unfortunately, I've been away working, and I'm gone for a little bit longer. So that's not going to be able to, you know, we're not going to be able to do that. But, if you guys, I said this on the Reddit, but, I'm not going to be skipping any more episodes. Well, unless the file gets corrupt, I'm not going to be skipping any more episodes. So I guess that's something I should say. Follow me at xfilesfiles, email me at thexfilesfiles@gmail.com. Please go vote for the show on iTunes. Give us 5 stars. You know, all that good stuff. Follow me at Kumail N. Oh, my show, The Meltdown with Jonah and Kumail. There's only a couple of episodes left. One of them is on tonight, 12:30 a.m. Every Wednesday after at midnight. And it's got, tonight's episode has Michael Ian Black in it. It has Gabe Liedman and Jenny Slate in it. It has Reggie Watts in it. It's a really, really, you know, I'm just really proud of this show. And I don't know yet if we're going to get another season. I hope we do, but even if we don't, you know, we got to work on something that we can be proud of. Maria Bamford is in it. I can't believe I didn't mention her. She's in it. And it's got surprise drop-ins from Jen Kirkman and Ron Funches. And it's a fun episode. It's a really, really funny. And everyone sort of does, you know, interesting, different kind of stuff on this episode. So I'm really proud of it. So please watch it. Thanks again for understanding, guys. I'm so sorry. I know you guys are bummed about it, but trust me, I'm way, 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 way more bummed about it. So I apologize, and I would love to say that it won't happen again, but, you know, it might. These things happen, and it's unavoidable. And I listen to a lot of podcasts, and every single podcast I listen to, there's one episode that people are like, oh man, that one's just gone. There's nothing we can do, you know? When it's a computer and you can't see the tape going, it's not that we didn't hit record. That's not it. It's a weird file thing. But, you know, when it isn't actually physical media, things go wrong. So, you know, or maybe it's a conspiracy by the government. I mean, you know, they didn't want our observation about Bradley Whitford going Rambo to be heard by everybody. So, hey, let's blame it on that. Thank you so much for understanding. See you guys next week.
Hey, baseball junkies, check out Duck Snort,
a baseball podcast for people who can't get enough baseball.
We talk with baseball fans and pros to bring you funny and thought-provoking conversations about America's pastime.
Like whether Mike Trout or Madison Bumgarner would win a skills competition.
Or if Bartolo Colon is a cyborg who will pitch until he's 100.
So subscribe to Duck Snort in Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcasting app.
Or visit DuckSnortPodcast.com.